Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm excited to share some great news. Both the Saturday Show and the Sunday Show are available as a podcast. Every weekend, I look forward to bringing you the most important political news and the newsmakers who are creating policies that affect your life. For me, it's all about the conversation. That's when news is revealed and understanding begins. Search for Saturdays and Sundays with Jonathan Capehart and follow.
Tonight on All In.
The hour's come for a new generation to lead the Democratic caucus that I so deeply respect.
A study in contrast as a Democratic giant steps aside and the MAGA wing takes power.
If we can keep it about Hunter Biden, this is kind of a big deal, we think. If we can keep it about Hunter Biden, that would be great.
Then the lawless redrawing of democracy that yielded a Republican majority and the explosion in dark money that funded it.
Democrats don't have to cheat. We don't have to gerrymander. Republicans do it.
And the best evidence yet that his own voters now see Donald Trump as a loser.
You know it, I know it, and everybody knows it.
When All In starts right now. Good evening from New York. I'm Chris Hayes. A changing of the guard is coming in Washington, D.C., one that I think we saw today on display, but more than that, embodies the difference between the two parties, the two coalitions they represent. Today, of course, Nancy Pelosi announced that she will be stepping down from House leadership after 20 years and a historic run as the first female Speaker of the House.
Fundamental mission to hold strong to our most treasured Democrat.
Tonight, Madam Speaker, history was made today, and that phrase was used for the first time ever when Nancy Pelosi of California was elected Speaker of the House and when her party took control from the Republicans for the first time in 12 years. Speaker Pelosi is now second in line to the presidency behind only the vice president.
I've been covering Nancy Pelosi for nearly two decades. She's a remarkably effective legislator and congressional leader, not just because she's a savvy politician, which she is, a great vote counter. What has made Nancy Pelosi truly great and her tenure so consequential is what she's accomplished. There's just a body of work, a substantive agenda that she either delivered or she blocked. On that note, in terms of what she blocked, among the first major challenges she ever faced after taking over as House Minority Leader back in 2003 was then President George W. Bush's proposal to privatize Social Security. Would have been a devastating, permanent, probably, transformation of the American welfare state and our social safety net. But Leader Pelosi was absolutely instrumental in blocking it. She resisted pressure to present a counterproposal to the Bush plan, calculating the Republican plan would collapse under its own weight. When members pestered her every week, asking when they were going to release a rival plan, and I remember when this was the case, the press was all like, well, what are the Democrats going to do? She was defiant, saying, quote, never, is never good enough for you? And you know what? It worked. Republicans tore themselves apart, never brought a bill to vote in the House or the Senate, just completely collapsed in on itself. Then in 2008, she was the Speaker as the financial crisis was erupting, the worst such crisis since the Great Depression. And she worked with the Bush administration to negotiate and then pass the legislation that backstopped the entire financial system and bailed out the banks, not particularly popular. At one point, Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson, who at that point was effectively running the U.S. government, leaned so heavily on Pelosi to help get the bailout through the House that he even got down on one knee to beg her to push the bill through. And again, Nancy Pelosi kept her cool and got the job done. But of course, it was in 2010 that she delivered the most significant achievement, the one that I think would be the capstone of her career, which is the health reform legislation, the largest of its kind since LBJ's Great Society. The Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, was all but left for dead after Scott Brown, now a high school girls basketball coach, won the special election for Ted Kennedy's Senate seat. Democrats lost their filibuster-proof majority in the Senate. They went from 60 to 59. They no longer had the votes in the Senate. But Nancy Pelosi would not give up.
We go through the gate. The gate's closed. We'll go over the fence. The fence is too high. We'll pole vault in. If that doesn't work, we'll parachute in. But we're going to get health care reform passed for the American people, for their own personal health and economic security, and for the important role that it'll play in reducing the deficit.
She did. I read a story about how Rahm Emanuel, at that point, chief of staff of President Obama, wanted to, like, basically abandon it and just pass a small little version of child health care, which she called the itsy bitsy teensy spider version, which she said she wouldn't do. No, she delivered the votes and passed Obamacare. They just passed the bill that had passed the Senate, rammed it through the House, got it done. Then in the first 2 years of the Biden administration, Nancy Pelosi and Democrats delivered on a slew of policy priorities. There was the American Rescue Plan, a $1.9 trillion recovery bill as we emerge from the worst parts of the pandemic, and the CHIPS Act, the infrastructure bill, which was passed on a bipartisan basis, the Inflation Reduction Act, which was the largest clean energy climate investment in history, $370 billion investment in clean energy. That's just to name a few. Speaker Pelosi also passed some really substantive legislation through the House the Senate didn't take up, including a voting rights package, a bill to protect abortion rights. So for two decades, Nancy Pelosi has carried out the agenda of the Democratic Party. And there are critics all over the place of that agenda. There are critics on the right, critics on the left. But it is an ambitious, sprawling agenda. And at times, she has done it with a very narrow majority. She's done it skillfully and shrewdly. And she has worked with both sides of the aisle, as she highlighted today.
It's been my privilege to play a part in forging extraordinary progress for the American people. I have enjoyed working with three presidents, achieving historic investments in clean energy with President George Bush. Transformative health care reform with President Barack Obama. And forging the future from infrastructure to health care to climate action with President Joe Biden.
Now, you might have noticed that Nancy Pelosi made one very obvious, deliberate omission there, the 4 years of Donald Trump's presidency. But she was really instrumental then, too. And this is something I think a lot of people have lost sight of, but to me is one of the sort of most notable moments in recent American governing history. In the midst of a once-in-a-century pandemic, Pelosi and the Democratic caucus in the House worked with members of the Trump administration, particularly Steve Mnuchin, and Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell to pass, in an election year, trillions of dollars in COVID relief. Trillions of dollars in COVID relief they had to know would boost the incumbent president's chances of reelection. It put money directly into pockets of millions of Americans. The checks that Trump put his name on, it kept countless businesses afloat. Trump would run on that, right? And they did it anyway. But I think that Pelosi's omission of Trump is not just about the righteous contempt that she obviously holds him in. I think she really does view the Trump years, particularly the two impeachments she oversaw, more in sorrow than in anger. I don't believe she sees those impeachments as accomplishments. Because I got to tell you, what Democratic lawmakers, almost all the Democratic lawmakers that I've ever known, interviewed as journalists, by and large, what they want to do when they get to Congress is pass laws, make policy. Some of the policy is good, some not so good, but that's what they want to do. They want to pass laws and make policy. And it's just not the case on the other side. And if you don't believe me, look at day one of the Republican House majority. It doesn't exist yet, but today was their rollout, right? They will be regaining control of the House with a slim majority. And as they talk about what they plan to do with this power, it all sounds more like a Steve Bannon podcast episode than an actual congressional agenda.
One of our highest priorities under a Republican Congress will be to stop left-wing censorship and to restore free speech.
So this is the focus on the Judiciary Committee, the political nature at the Justice Department, and the linkage now to what was happening with the Hunter Biden story.
We also want to get to the bottom of the origination of COVID-19.
I'm really happy Dr. Fauci's retiring, because that's going to give a lot of time for him to sit in our committees.
We can impeach Secretary Mayorkas. We can impeach Merrick Garland.
So I'm introducing articles of impeachment against Joe Biden on Monday.
Now, we also just learned that that individual, Georgia Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, extracted a promise from Republican leaders that they will investigate Speaker Nancy Pelosi and the Justice Department for their treatment of defendants jailed in connection with January 6th. Now, let's be clear. American jails are generally pretty awful, okay? And everyone, no matter the crime, no matter who they are, what their politics are, deserves to be treated humanely. That often is not the case in our system. But what's happening here is that Republicans, certain section of them, Marjorie Taylor Greene, believe that these folks who carried out a violent insurrection by breaking the Capitol and hunt down elected leaders are basically political prisoners. And Marjorie Taylor Greene, along with some of her fellow Republicans, are already threatening to shut down the government. Again, none of this is that surprising, considering they don't, again, really have a substantive agenda to work on anyway, or at least not a popular one. The most coherent version they could possibly cobble together would include, I don't know, some platitudes about respecting life with no specifics from Republican leader Kevin McCarthy. And then, of course, Republican Senator Rick Scott's much criticized plan to cut Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. I am sure they will also find a way to try to cut taxes for rich people and big corporations. That's the one thing you can always bet on. It's the one thing they all agree on. It's the one thing they know how to do. So today, when you compare Jim Jordan in his shirt sleeves wailing about Hunter Biden's laptop to the pillars of the American social welfare state that Nancy Pelosi has overseen, that is exactly what the two different parties stand for at this moment. David Plouffe is a former campaign manager for Obama's 2008 presidential run, as well as a former senior advisor to President Obama, and he joins me now. It's great to have you here.
Great to be with you, Chris.
Let's start with the day one of the Republican House. And it was wild because it felt to me like they just had this very disappointing showing. It seemed to me to show that they were stuck a little bit in their own bubble. They believed their own hype. They weren't communicating with median voters. And day one, they come out and it's like just all base maintenance.
Yeah, they're doubling down, tripling down. I mean, listen, a lot of House Republicans make people like Blake Masters and Mehmet Oz and even Herschel Walker look like, you know, milquetoast moderates.
Yeah.
So I guarantee you that maybe there's 10% of the electorate that was voting for investigations on Hunter Biden and to make it easy for insurrectionists in prison. That's about it. Everybody else wants you to focus on kitchen table issues. So it is predictable, and I don't think it's going to change. And Kevin McCarthy has no control. What's fascinating about this is the people in his caucus who should have the strongest voice are the members who just won in New York, the ones that had in California that delivered the majority. That is something about Nancy Pelosi. She always put her vulnerable members first. Now, she obviously had to cater to the left and, you know, the center right in the caucus, but she really saw the world through their eyes. And Kevin McCarthy already on day one has basically said the crazy, the ghost horses, the MTGs, they're going to drive the bus here. And it is so far away from what the American people just screamed very loudly last week. They wanted the country and their leaders to focus on.
It's funny you said that because it's very true, right? And this would often be very frustrating to progressives in the caucus. You know, this focus on the moderates, and they're the kind of weather vane that guides a caucus. But there are exceptions to that. And the biggest one, of course, is the ACA. And to me, you know, I say this to people all the time about politics, which is that, yes, donors are massively important. And yes, politics are massively important. But it does matter at the end of the day what politicians believe in. Yeah. They really do things purely for like ideological reasons or accomplishment. Nancy Pelosi pushed through the ACA against all other rational consideration. She knew it was going to decimate the caucus. She did it because she believed the Democrats should deliver health care reform.
Yeah, well, I was in the Oval Office with President Obama the night of the Massachusetts election when Scott Brown won and lost our 60 Senates. And remember, by the way, working in the West Wing is about as far from the West Wing show as you can get. But that night, he basically said, listen, if we give up now, it'll be 25 or 30 years before we get health care. And you pointed out there was opposition to that decision in the White House. A lot of Senate Democrats, some in the House. The person that was most steadfast along with President Obama was Nancy Pelosi. And it was remarkable. And I think at the end of the day, she realized even though we're in a financial crisis, even though it's clear Democrats were going to have a really horrible election, we just had two in a row. So even in a neutral environment, you're going to give a lot back. She saw this was the opportunity, really once in a generation.
Yeah.
It had been 100 years. And she deserves enormous credit for that because it was... There was such opposition to that. It was the itsy bitsy bill. A lot of people wanted no bill at all. And she put that on her back.
Yeah, she did. And the accounts of that, and I saw that up close, I'll never forget talking to a member that day after the morning after the Brown election. Progressive member was like, it's done. It's done. Yeah. We're dead. It's dead. Here's the other thing that I note about her is managing the caucus. I thought this reporting that came out in a book about the two impeachments, about how she tried to kind of manage that she was caught between progressives who wanted to leave no stone unturned by pursuing multiple potential crimes by Trump, including Mueller's evidence, violations of the Constitution's Emoluments Clause, hush money payments, and politically vulnerable Democrats who pushed for a more narrow, tailored strategy would get the saga over with as quickly as possible. She also, according to the reporting, sort of held back this cry for impeachment early on, even though I thought it was substantively justified almost from the jump. That's the thing that if Kevin McCarthy has any political wits, he's going to have to try to do, I think. But what do you think about their relative abilities to do that?
He's not going to be able to do it. It's always fascinating. So Nancy Pelosi, obviously from one of the most Democratic districts in the country in San Francisco, she's always had a thumb on the heartbeat of, you know, Ohio and swing areas in North Carolina, Virginia. So listen, I was on Capitol Hill, worked for Democratic leader Gephardt at the time during Clinton's impeachment. I can tell you how tricky that is. And to watch her navigate this, and it was, you know, we had the pandemic. You had an unguided missile in the White House and Trump. You had two impeachments. And somehow she was able to navigate this. It didn't make everybody happy, but she did it with great skill. Kevin McCarthy has no chance to control his caucus. None. My only question, quite frankly, is how many speakers of the House are going to be in this Congress? Two, three, four? It's possible.
I think that's a great point, and I don't even think it's guaranteed he'll be the speaker. The final question, I think, is... when when Clinton ran in 96, everyone thought Clinton was dead in 94. And Newt Gingrich becomes an incredible foil in 96 in that re-election, which he trounces Bob Dole. At the pure level of politics, how much does a House caucus bowing to its most extreme members help the opposite party incumbent president?
Well, the most important factor in 24 will be who the nominees are. That, you know, that's Broadway. But there'll be a sense from voters. They just said... you know, that we've got to remember, yes, the Democrats did a lot of important things in the last Congress, but that was more a vote against the Republicans than the Democrats, in my view, what we just saw last week. And so they said, we don't want the craziest of the crazy.
Right.
So
they're going to see
is, well, the Republicans are crazy. And if we give them a Republican president, they'll be crazier. And listen, you got to remember, like, let's look at New York. First of all, the new Democratic leader, Hakeem Jeffries, is from New York. Pretty helpful if you want to win back four seats you just lost in New York. It's in your backyard. And these are all going to be occurring in a presidential year. So right now, Kevin McCarthy and all the Republicans, they don't act like it. You know, I think their majority is on borrowed time, even though they just gained it.
Yeah.
And so I don't think he's going to be able to control this at all, because, again, he's made his decision. The people who are driving the bus are the people in safe districts, the most MAGA people, not the people who just led him to the majority in places like New York and California.
Well, and one other person was the guy that runs the party, who's down in Mar-a-Lago, who's basically
diminished as he is.
Yes, but
right.
not with the Marjorie Taylor Greens
of
the world. David Plouffe, great to have you here in person. Come back anytime. Coming up, Republicans took back control of the House, but they won their narrow lead by disenfranchising thousands of voters. The ongoing gerrymandering scandal. Next. So Republicans are now in control of the House of Representatives with a very thin majority of what NBC News projects will be just three or four seats, basically. How Republicans achieved this majority in what was otherwise a really bad election year for the party was due in no small part to the gerrymandering that was done in states that Republicans controlled the process in. So take, for example, Alabama. It's a state in which about 27% of the population is black. Ahead of this election, Republicans drew this congressional map you see on your screen for the state. It puts much of the black population into just that one district you see, the one blue district. So you get one seat. That might look big there geographically, but it's one of seven districts. So one out of seven, that's 14%. That's half the percentage-wise of what the black population is in the state. Civil rights groups sued them over this, and a federal panel of judges ruled that the map violates the Voting Rights Act. They ordered Alabama to redraw the map and add another majority black district. But Republicans took the case to their friends on the Trump Supreme Court, and the conservative majority there said, no, the map gives white voters disproportionate power is fine. Go on. Basically, the exact same thing happened next door in Louisiana. Louisiana is one of the blackest states in the country. A third of Louisiana citizens are black, 33%. And once again, Republicans drew a map with one majority black district out of six, right? And a federal judge ruled the map was illegal for the exact same reason. The federal judge ordered a second majority black district drawn. And the Trump Supreme Court said, no, map is fine. So that's two states, two seats, right? In Florida, it was even more egregious. In Florida, Republican Governor Ron DeSantis forced the Republican state legislature to actually take away the mostly black district you see on the left. That was the original plan, okay? And break it up into four red districts you can see on the new map on the right. This time, it was Florida's own state Supreme Court, dominated by Republicans, which upheld the bias map. That's three seats right there. There's a bunch of other examples of Republican gerrymanders either approved by the courts or pursued in defiance of the courts. In Ohio, they basically just told this state Supreme Court to take a long walk off a short pier. But these three alone, that's three seats. Alabama, Louisiana, and Florida eliminated three House seats, which likely would have gone to the Democrats. Catherine Sadasivan is the redistricting counsel for the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. She worked on both the Alabama and Louisiana redistricting cases I just mentioned, and she joins me now. It's great to have you. Catherine, can you just sort of lay out the case of what current U.S. voting rights law, the Voting Rights Act, 14th Amendment, says about the questions that were issued in the two really clear cases in Alabama and Louisiana?
Sure, Chris. Thanks. So the Voting Rights Act of 1965, as even Chief Justice Roberts recognized in his dissent in our Alabama case, prevents state legislatures from packing and cracking black voters, in particular, in a way to dilute their voting power. That's also prohibited by the 14th Amendment. The Voting Rights Act, in particular, prevents any kind of discriminatory map that has the effect of denying black voters their, or any voters of color, a fair opportunity to elect candidates of their choice. And in places like Alabama and Louisiana, where we both brought cases, there is a significant history of racial discrimination in voting, but across all sectors of life. So in health, in public education, in healthcare access, and kind of the daily, things that we consider good representation to usually take account of, the lack of political representation affects Black voters in particular. And so the Voting Rights Act, as it stood or as it stands today, would have prevented the legislatures in Alabama and Louisiana, and indeed in Florida, from enacting maps that deny Black voters a fair opportunity to elect their candidates of choice, and would have required, as federal courts in the district in Alabama and including the Fifth Circuit in Louisiana found, would have required those legislatures or through the court to have enacted a map that provided Black voters with an additional opportunity to elect a candidate of choice, meaning that two districts would have allowed Black voters to elect candidates of choice, right, and all of the commensurate representation that comes with that.
So, I mean, the basic math here, right, is that, like, for years, right, before the Voting Rights Act, you know, it doesn't matter how black your state is, right? If you control the districts, you could just make sure that there's no black majorities in any districts. You have an all-white state legislature. You got an all-white congressional district, whether you're Mississippi, Louisiana, like, that's it, right? Voting Rights Act comes along and says, can't do that anymore. And so then the question is, well, what's the standard here? And if you look at a place like Alabama, it's like, look, the math works out that there should probably be two black representatives in this congressional delegation. The Republicans say, you get one. And then there's a trial where a federal judge says, no, you have to do this. You have to draw a second majority black district in Alabama. And then why does that not happen? I still don't understand.
So, I mean, it's in part thanks to the Supreme Court's weaponization of its shadow docket, whereby it, without kind of full briefing and merit, grants the state a stay of the district court's decision. In this case, it was, in Alabama, it was a weaponization of a case that meant that voters and, election administrators are confused by changes too close to an election. And so, that somehow justifies discriminatory maps which deny voters within the state an opportunity to elect a candidate and requires, in fact, that a discriminatory map effectively must go into effect for at least one election before it can be remedied. In Louisiana, I should note, though, the Supreme Court didn't give any justification whatsoever. It was not too close to a candidate qualifying deadline or indeed any election deadline. The Supreme Court just decided that it seemed poised possibly to change the applicable standard for Section 2 Voting Rights Act cases, and that it would hold the case and Louisiana voters in limbo until it rendered a decision in the Alabama case.
So the Alabama case has now been argued, and so we'll get a decision from the court. It likely is not going to be good, but there is an outside chance that this can be remedied in the future, though there's also a chance the court basically keeps taking the sledgehammer to the pillars of the Voting Rights Act, which seems more likely. Catherine Sadasivan, thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Chris.
Still ahead, wealthy donors dumped billions of dollars into the midterm elections, but we will never know exactly where a lot of the money came from. It's wild. Democratic Senator Sheldon Whitehouse joins me on the dangers of dark money next. The amount of money spent in the 2022 midterm elections was record-breaking. Candidates and political action committees spent nearly $17 billion on state and federal campaigns. Both parties took in massive amounts of money, and there were races where each party outspent the other. It wasn't clear in the aggregate. So one example, Florida Democratic Senate candidate Val Demings, who lost to incumbent Republican Senator Marco Rubio, outspent him by about $26 million. But the big difference between the two parties here is the source of all that money, whether it comes from small dollar donations or the mega rich. According to the New York Times, quote, of the 25 top donors this cycle, right, the biggest givers, 18 are Republican, according to Open Secrets, and they have outspent Democrats by $200 million. Billionaires make up 20% of total Republican donations compared with 14.5% of Democratic donations. Like Peter Thiel, the billionaire Republican mega donor who spent over $32 million in the Senate races of just two of his former employees, J.D. Vance in Ohio and Blake Masters in Arizona. Or the three billionaires who shelled out nearly $20 million for Wisconsin Republican Senator Ron Johnson's reelection campaign. The Supreme Court's Citizens United decision from 2010, which paved the way for corporations and outside groups to spend limitless amounts of money on elections, has basically meant that billionaires can give as much as they want, often in secret. They can spend to tilt the playing field in Democratic elections, and there is not much people can do about it. One person who has been trying to take action on all this dark money is Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, a Democrat from Rhode Island, author of The Scheme, How the Right Wing Used Dark Money to Capture the Supreme Court. And he joins me now. Senator, your focus on a lot of this has been on the court, but I want to talk just for a moment about the problems this presents in the electoral arena. I mean, it seems to me one of the original justifications for campaign finance law was, look, let's say you have a billionaire who just says, I'm going to sponsor a U.S. senator, and I'm going to spend whatever it is to get that person elected. I think we all have the intuition that that senator is going to be pretty beholden to that lone billionaire when they get in office. Is that a concern that you have?
Yeah, it's a huge concern. And it actually gets even worse because very often the billionaire isn't picking a particular candidate. The billionaire is going to Mitch McConnell and saying, right, we'll dump $20 million into this race. We'll dump $20 million into that race. We'll dump $20 million into this race. And nobody will ever see who we are because we've hidden ourselves behind these phony front groups. But you, Mitch McConnell, and I, the billionaire, we know who you owe. And we're going to have a deal about that. And you're going to damn sure not do a climate bill ever. And I'll keep pouring the $20 billion checks in. So I think that's even worse, because when you align the billionaire with the candidate publicly, at least the people can see that racket happening. Oh, it's rotten. But when they don't even see it, the rottenness still has its effect, but the public doesn't have a chance to understand.
Well, the scope of this is really blowing my mind. We're getting reporting about the size of these dark money investments, some of them flowing to Leonard Leo, who's a big sort of conservative rainmaker, was the one responsible for the 6-3 Trump court. One of the biggest conservative dark money organizations in the nation was boosted last year by two separate anonymous gifts, each totaling more than $425 million. That organization, yeah, Donors Trust, used those funds to support a vast network of prominent conservative causes, including a $17 million gift it made to the 85 Fund, a group funded by a major engine of the conservative movement, Leonard Leo. But these are enormous, enormous donations that are going into you know, effectively political work anonymously.
Yeah, if you add up those two donations that went through donors' trust, the identity laundering machine of right-wing billionaires, with the $1.6 billion that went into that same Leonard Leo network through a single contribution from a single billionaire, now you're at nearly $2.5 billion launched into this dark money network. And as evil as that is in terms of the way it plays itself out in our politics, just think what those donors had in mind. What was their goal? What were the quiet, secret deals that were entered into in the back rooms? That is what is so bad about this, because the public never gets to see any of this. They just get angry that they feel they're being cheated by their Congress because they won't listen. And of course they won't listen when they got people who write $2.5 billion in checks.
Then there's the court, of course, which is part of, which is both the root, it's both a root and a product, right, of this.
Correct. It's a vicious cycle.
Right.
The court opens up the dark money packs the court.
So, yeah, I mean, I guess the question is, what's the way out, right? The court's jurisprudence on this has gotten more and more permissive and laissez-faire about anything having to do with campaign finance regulation. They had a major case in the last term in which you can pay yourself back from loans, basically personally fundraise in ways that had previously been prohibited. That was brought by your colleague, Ted Cruz. What is the way out of the vicious cycle?
That wasn't the worst one. Let me tell you what the worst one was.
Please.
You know very well from all your research what the Americans for Prosperity organization is. It's the Koch brothers political organization's major battleship. Attached to it is a 501c3 so they can launder tax deductible money into this operation. And that was called the Americans for Prosperity Foundation. And that foundation sued, and the six right-wingers on the Supreme Court, the six Federal Society justices, created a brand new constitutional right for anonymous donors to hide their identities in that case. They took away the right to choose and have physical autonomy over your childbearing from half the population. They took that right away, and they added a new right for dark money billionaires to push money into the system without disclosing their identities. It's stunning.
Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, who has been laser focused on this topic for as long as I have covered him, has a new book out about it. I appreciate you taking time tonight. Thank you.
Thanks, Chris.
Still to come, with 3 weeks until the Georgia runoff, Senator Raphael Warnock ties an electoral anchor around Herschel Walker.
Get out and vote for Herschel, and he deserves it. He was an incredible athlete. He'll be an even better senator. Get out and vote for Herschel Walker.
Can Donald Trump help the Democrats hold on to yet another Senate seat? That's next. The Georgia runoff for U.S. Senate is less than 3 weeks away. It's on December 6th. It's going to feature a rematch between Democratic Senator Raphael Warnock and, of course, Trump-backed Herschel Walker, who, for a number of reasons, is just a historically bad candidate, from his abortion scandals to the three children he never publicly acknowledged until they were revealed during the campaign, the domestic violence allegations leveled at him by his own family. There have been a lot of marks against Walker's candidacy, but right now, the thing working against him most is not all that. It is his association with one of the most toxic names out there, ex-President Donald Trump. An association that Senator Warnock is playing up in a new ad.
We must all work very hard for a gentleman and a great person named Herschel Walker, a fabulous human being who loves our country and will be a great United States Senator. Herschel Walker, get out and vote for Herschel, and he deserves it. He was an incredible athlete. He'll be an even better senator. Get out and vote for Herschel Walker.
I'm Raphael Warnock, and I approve this message.
That's it. No joke. That's the whole ad. Donald Trump wants you to vote for Herschel Walker. So to stop Donald Trump, Warnock says voters have to stop Herschel Walker. And right there, that tells you how much Trump's endorsements of candidates is actually a curse. Right now, Donald Trump is arguably the least popular and the weakest he has ever been in his political life since 2015. We've been hearing this a lot recently following the very poor showing at the midterms of almost all the swing state candidates that he endorsed. But we now have some data demonstrating it. Take a look at these exit polls on Trump's favorability with midterm voters. In Pennsylvania, swing state, key state, right? Key piece to both Joe Biden's 2020 victory, to Trump's victory in 2016, to the current Democratic Senate majority. In that state, that key bellwether state, an overwhelming 58% view him unfavorably. He's underwater by 18 points. Wisconsin, another key swing state. Nearly 60% of voters view the president unfavorably. Even in Ohio, right? That's a state that Trump won by 7 points, 8 points. It's also a state where Republicans elected Trump-backed J.D. Vance, the Senate, one of the bright spots. A majority of voters in Ohio, again, have an unfavorable opinion of Trump. Tara Settmayer works as a Republican communication director on Capitol Hill. Stuart Stevens worked as a political strategist on dozens of Republican campaigns. Both are now senior advisors at the Lincoln Project, and they join me now. Tara, let me start with you. Those numbers on election night when we first started getting exits, the numbers from swing states of his favorability jumped out at me as a flashing red light early in the night about what kind of night it might be. Am I overreading that?
No, because guess who else it jumped out at? Republicans, Republican elected leaders, Mitch McConnell and others who looked at this and went, yeah, well, we try to tell you candidate quality matters. And when the candidate is backed by Donald Trump and the MAGA wing of the Republican Party, it's extreme. The American people rejected it in 2020. They want no parts of that moving forward, particularly in these swing states. And the voting totals showed us that. I mean, it's very clear. If you look at the five swing states where the most MAGA candidates were, the election deniers, democracy deniers, as I call them, they were all defeated. And Lincoln Project was right on that because we recognized that those states needed to make sure that those MAGA election deniers didn't get into positions of power or we'd have a constitutional crisis in 2024. So you're not the only one it stood out to, Chris. That's why there's an internecine warfare developing right now within the Republican Party of who to blame for them not getting the, quote, red wave that they thought they would. Two words, Donald Trump.
The key thing to me here, Stuart, is independence. And again, you know, there's a lot of structural changes that have happened to the American electorate over time. There's a lot of more polarization. We see a lot more straight ticket voting than we used to. But there are still swing voters, A. There's still ticket splitting, B. We saw it in this midterms. And Trump is just toxic to independent voters. Like, there's just no two ways about it. The data is very clear on this.
Yeah, and that's a big problem, but it's not a problem for him really in the Republican primary. You have to realize, I mean, on election day in 16, what was Trump's favorable? I mean, it was 41, 42. And I worked for Romney in 12 on election day, Romney and Obama's favorables were both at 50%.
Yeah.
And you have to ask yourself, are we ever going to see that again, at least, you know, in the next few elections with two kind of equally liked candidates? Donald Trump, I think, is going to win this primary because he does best as an underdog. The problem Donald Trump had in 20 was running as an incumbent. He then was responsible for things like lots of people dying of COVID.
Right.
He's out of that now. And anything that's wrong in the country, he's going to blame Joe Biden. And I think Republicans, they're going to respond to this and they're going to nominate him. And, you know, we're going to do everything we can to defeat him. But I think it's foolish to think that it won't be another close election.
Yeah, I mean, that point I think about not being responsible for anything is key. I think it's, you know, it's sort of where I think frankly, it's where the Republican Party as a whole thrives. Which is not in governing, it's in opposition. And I think also, Tara, to the point that Stuart just made, this is, I think, the grand theory here, right? That everyone kind of, people, elites in the Republican Party, political professionals, thought that Trump would be a disaster. They looked at those favorability ratings and they thought, this guy's going to be toxic. And he pulls out this improbable victory in 2016, which is very fluky and it's born of the electoral college and loses by 3 million votes. And people basically thought they got it wrong, that there was something that they hadn't seen. And I think they basically overlearned the lesson. The question is, are they unlearning it now?
No, I think that there was something that was overlooked. I mean, we look at what was unearthed by Donald Trump. He gave a permission structure for people to be racist and bigoted and obnoxious and indecent. And the Republican Party said, oh, OK, I guess that's how we need to be now. And we saw, but it doesn't work for everyone. Only Donald Trump seems to be able to get away with that. He has a lot of people imitating him, including Ron DeSantis, who thinks that he can be a better version of Trump. But only Donald Trump can get away with it. It is an anomaly here, but one that is still extremely dangerous. And in my opinion, and I know Stu feels the same way, that you underestimate his influence at your own peril. And we cannot do that because there's still millions of people who support him. And the election was actually a lot closer last time around in 2020 than a lot of people want to realize, because we still do have an electoral college. It's not popular vote. And that's where you need to focus it. It was quite close for Joe Biden in 2020 after everything that Trump has done, said, did, how many people died and what we went through.
Yeah, that's a good point. And it speaks to the importance of these swing states, which is part of why I think it's so striking what happened in those five states, in Wisconsin, in Pennsylvania, in Michigan, in Arizona and Georgia. Right. I mean, that was, if you look at those, I mean, they're going to go one in three, maybe 0-4 in the statewide offices in Arizona that were on the ballot. Georgia, Stuart, it's striking to me that Warnock put that ad out where their calculation is association with this guy in this really narrowly divided state hurts Walker more than it helps him.
Oh, hell yeah. Put Donald Trump on the ballot if you're Warnock. I mean, I think that's the simplest proposition going. Everybody who wants to vote for Donald Trump is going to already be voting for Walker. It shows other people out there.
That's right.
So look, I don't think this race, it's not going to be a blowout, but I don't think it's going to be particularly close. Who in the world really, you know, wants Herschel Walker as a U.S. senator? I mean, think about it. Is any other U.S. senator in the next 6 years going to ask themselves when there's a question like, I wonder what Herschel thinks? I think I'll ask him. I mean, you know, Georgia's had some great senators, Sam Nunn, some others. I worked for Johnny Isaacson. So I think this guy's going to lose. But, you know, The essence of what Trump did was he was able to maximize white turnout, lower frequency white voters with a largely racist, xenophobic appeal. And we always thought that you would lose the college-educated voters. And that didn't happen in 16. It did happen in 20.
And it looks like it's gonna stay. Tara Setmayer and Stuart Stevens, thank you very much. That does it for All In. You can catch us every weeknight at 8 o'clock on MSNBC. Don't forget to like us on Facebook. That's facebook.com/allinwithchris.
Here on MSNBC, we are staying on top of several fast-moving stories.
Today's news requires more facts.
A new report finds the climate crisis is getting much worse.
More context.
We are seeing record numbers of people crossing into the United States just in the southern border.
And more ground covered.
The mission will continue to carry out regime change in the Gaza Strip.
The world's never been harder to understand. That's why it's never been more important to try. MSNBC. Understand more.